Answering your tough financial questions for the past 21 years, it's Hanson McLean's Money Matters with co-hosts Scott Hanson and Pat McLean. Would you like an opinion on a financial matter you're dealing with? Whether it is about retirement, investments, taxes, or 401ks, Scott Hanson and Pat McLean would like to help you by answering your call. To join Hanson McLean's Money Matters, call now at 1-888-2-HANSON. That's 1-888-2-HANSON.
Welcome to Hanson McLean's Money Matters. I'm Scott Hanson.
I'm Pat McLean.
Thanks for joining us today as we talk about financial issues. Both myself and my co-host here, we're both financial advisors, certified financial planner, chartered financial consultant, and we spend our weekdays meeting with people like yourself, helping them plan their financial futures. And we come here on the weekends to be your financial advisors on the air. And much of our topic is around retirement planning issues because that's
where the value's added.
The biggest issue most Americans are facing at some point in their life. But it's really about all other areas of finances as well. So regardless of what your question you're thinking about with finances, would love to take a call from you and love to be of assistance in any way we can.
So an example of that would be college funding. Do I need life insurance, long-term care insurance, Medicare, supplements to a degree, although it's not our strong suit.
Supplements? Supplements?
No, Medicare supplements.
Oh, you just said supplements.
No. Medicare supplements. How do you fund a college education? 401ks, Roth IRAs. It can get pretty, actually, there is not a lack of choices or products out there to serve the American consumer when it comes to saving money. There's a lack of good products and good advice, but there's not a lack of products.
There's an old saying on Wall Street, when the ducks quack, feed them. Which Wall Street will create whatever the market is buying, whether it's good or bad.
It isn't super interested in the outcome as much as, well, I shouldn't say that. The outcome.
Hopefully most investment advisors, someone you're sitting down with, someone who's helping you personally, has your best interest at heart. And an independent advisor who is a registered investment advisor has a fiduciary obligation to put your needs first. But Wall Street as a whole
does not. And I was thinking that that's probably not true, but it is true because they created the credit default swaps order to sell and carve them up in such a manner to sell them easier.
And if you look at the mutual funds that get created through market cycles, it's when things are hot. It's where the money's flowing. So the other mutual fund product manufacturers, like in the late 90s, the dot com. I'll never forget a client a number of years. She comes in 2000, demanding to buy a technology fund in her portfolio. They need tech fund. It's January of 2000.
Which is?
If I remember correctly, the portfolio as a whole had outperformed the S&P 500 with 60% of the risk because of the diversified nature of it. And I remember I finally acquiesced and
put a little bit I'm going to guess Janus funds at the time because it was the most popular.
In any case, it declined dramatically, of course. But it was at the time, I remember, every mutual fund complex was coming out with these things. The same thing still happens today.
Yes. The Wall Street and the insurance industry will manufacture products because there's an appetite for it. Whether it's good for you or appropriate for you is a completely different story. but that's why you, as a consumer, as an investor, you have to actually be very, very careful. You have to actually do due diligence on the products that are being offered to you and the advice that you're being given.
Which is a fancy term for research.
Yes, that's correct.
I remember I never even heard that term until my first job. And I had a graduated with a degree in business. I never even heard the term due diligence.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
Until I had my first job.
You went to Chico State, though.
Well, okay, then. I am a certified financial planner.
I take that back because I have college-age children, and many of their friends are going to and are at Chico State. It's a good school.
I did have a friend tease me just this last week. I had met him for breakfast, and my license plate rim on my car, I've had this for a number of years.
A rim or
License plate frame.
Okay, because the rims are on.
I'm not actually that big of a car guy, but I tend to have, I drive a big,
fancy car,
kind of overpriced sedan.
Yeah,
I just like the big little man, big car. That's what I say. And so I have on my license plate, Chico State alumni, and? Alumni Chico State. And what? That's a long.
Do you get comments for it?
Well, he was teasing me the other day about it, and I said the reason I put it on there is because.
Your school was maligned so much that
there's yes, and a lot of times it's just because you had to start somewhere does not mean it's going to determine your entire journey.
We all start somewhere, and the child graduates, not the school.
Matter of fact, I was just this week reading about this article, it was an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal about how the guy did not go to Harvard, right? But his friend kind of mistaken him as a Harvard grad, would tease him about being a Harvard. Anyway, the whole.
Anyway.
Why am I so off this topic?
So
I did, however, in all fairness, I am a distinguished alum from Chico State. They awarded me with a distinguished alum. I was also on the Dean's Honors roll and was the president of the Business Honor Society. So why it may not have been as for my undergraduate work at
You don't have Stanford. Any self-esteem issues whatsoever, Mr. Hansen.
And furthermore, I am a certified financial planner with roughly 3 decades of experience. And co-CEO of a firm with almost $4 billion under administration with thousands of satisfied clients.
Okay, well, thank you for the resume.
Frankly, I am doing this.
Okay, to demonstrate that the child
before
graduates.
Before somebody changes the radio station or turns off the podcast.
But the demonstration is the child graduates, not the school.
As I was being interviewed for an industry publication at a conference, and the interviewee, the reporter, made some wisecrack about Chico's, just not some other Chico State grad. I said, well, before you start the interview, you might want to know that I'm a Chico State, because I've been listed, we've both been listed in the top advisors in the country under Barron several years, so she assumed I must have went to some high school.
Yeah, it doesn't.
I'm like, no, I went to...
Actually, it doesn't matter. What the school you go to matters? But the person you are actually matters.
All right, and we are off topic.
Okay, we're going to do some financial talk here. We're going to talk about money.
Why don't we take some calls, because this is a call and talk program. So if you'd like to join the program, our call-in number is 1-888-2-HANSON. That's 1-888-2-HANSON. Numerically, it's 1-888-242-6766. We'll take some calls. Also, you want to continue to hear this program, though, if you've still stuck on to the Chico State conversation. The second half, we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about charitable contributions, how to maximize those, donor advised funds, and those sort of issues. So you want to stick around for that. But right now, let's take some calls. We're going to start off in Northern California with Michael. Michael, you're with Hanson McLean.
Hi, you guys. Thanks for taking my call. Thanks. I have a Roth IRA question for you.
Fire away.
Both my wife and I have our own IRAs, our own Roth IRAs, and had them for a number of years, but we haven't always been able to fund them fully or consistently in the past. But now we have some extra money and want to fund the accounts. But there's one hitch. My wife is no longer earning any income, and I'm wondering, is there anything that prevents me from funding both of them with my income?
Only if your income is above, $190,000 or something, because you can do a spousal IRA.
Or below the amount that you're contributing.
Okay, yeah, so I'm under that 190 threshold.
Yeah, ballpark, give or take.
So there's no, I don't have to open a new account. It's just using her existing Roth IRA.
That's correct.
Okay. It's just called a spousal. So no tax implications with that then.
Nope.
Okay.
And the limits go up next year.
The limits go up in 2019.
Okay. So I think currently this year it's $5,500.
For the limits on it, the Roth IRA limits for 2018 is $5,500, and you've got until April 15th to make that contribution. And then for 2019, the limit is $6,000, plus a $1,000 catch-up for age 50 and older.
Okay.
And you can make those all in a single check for both years, 2018 and 2019, which is what I find easiest to do. That's just me.
Yeah, so I was going to ask. So I can. So theoretically, I could. I've been putting. I've been doing installments in my Roth this year, so mine will be almost. You know, mine will be fully funded by the end of the year, and then so I could write a check for my wife's contribution this year and for next year anytime I wanted, then, right?
You can't write a check for 2019 unless you're in the calendar year 2019.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But I could put $5,500 into hers in, say, December, and then in January put the $6,000 in hers.
And if she's over age 50, you could put $1,000 more in.
Okay. Okay. So is it better to put a lump sum in right away?
It doesn't matter. Over the long term, it's not going to make any difference. I mean, technically, the sooner you get it in, the sooner, the better.
Technically.
Right, because the money's working for you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or not working. Then, we don't know that.
Or, yeah.
But then we know that the markets go up more than they go down. So the
probability is if you do it at the beginning, January 1, every year for the years in which you're investing.
Yes, that would be better.
Then you're better off.
There we go. Whether that's convenient or not. Yes, on January 2nd, you should be in the financial institution's office with your money.
Every year.
Okay.
All righty?
Now, one other question, if I could. I'm not maxing out my 401k, but pretty close. Should I do that before funding any of the Roth IRAs?
How old are you?
I'm in my late 40s.
What's your family income?
About 150. Thousand.
How much? What percentage of your retirement savings? What percentage is in Roth versus tax deferred?
Oh, it's probably 50-50.
Oh,
I'd do the 401k.
I would too. I'd max out the 401k.
I'd max out the 401k before I did the Roth.
I maxed out that first.
If your income was lower, I'd probably say do the Roth. But
no,
if it were me, I'd max out the 401k first.
401k first.
Okay.
All righty.
Awesome.
All right,
guys.
Appreciate the call.
Good luck. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
And let's head up to Seattle, Washington, talking with Steve. Steve, you're with Hanson McLean.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I truly appreciate it.
Well, thanks for calling.
I listen to your show every week, and I've read your book, Personal Decision Points, probably four times.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
But
you're the one.
Anyway, I'm actually calling.
I said, you're the one.
Yeah, I'm the one. I'm actually calling for a question. It's more related for my daughter, more so than myself. And my question is, she just got married recently. Her and her husband live in San Francisco. And up to this point, have barely had enough to survive, given the cost of living in the Bay Area. And then recently she got a new job and he got an increase. So now they're finally making a decent amount of money whereby they can start thinking about saving and investing and all that good stuff. And so between them, they make about $170,000 now, and they want to start contributing. Well, I should preface it and say about $100,000 is hers. She works for a large company, and then he's self-employed. He makes about... to start putting 15% into the company 401k. And I suggested that at her age, she's 28, he's 29, that they start putting it all into a Roth. And they came back and basically said, well, maybe they'd rather do some tax diversification and maybe put a split it Roth and a traditional. And I was just trying to get somebody's opinion
that
is knowledgeable in the area as to what makes the most sense.
Well, the challenge in California, the tax rates are highly progressive. So if your income's low, you pay nothing. But as you start getting higher, they're at a point they're paying over 9% in California state income taxes. I think about 9.3%.
Right.
That's the rate they're at, in addition to federal taxes. So the federal tax, they're probably at, 23%? I'm trying to remember what the exact new rates are. But
I think it's 24 now.
Okay, 24.
And is there a chance ever that they end up back in the state of Washington in Seattle? I assume that's where they're from, or is that where they're from?
She's from Seattle. He's from the Bay Area, and he started his own business down there. Got so it. I don't see it anytime soon.
Well, I kind of like the concept of splitting the difference down the middle. You know, it's interesting. If you maximize the Roth 401k contributions, at retirement, you end up with more
net spendable income
because
after
there's
tax,
not taxes.
Spendable income.
Now, you might argue that, well, you forego the tax break, but if they took advantage of the 401k and then saved that tax savings, then maybe you can argue that taking the deductible is the best way to go. From our experience, I've never seen anybody who saved that, right? I've never seen it. Now I think about it, in 20, almost 30 years of doing this, I've never seen anyone who's taken the 401k and that tax savings is that I'm going to take those extra dollars and save it somewhere else.
So I don't think it's a bad idea to split it down the middle. And he would use a self-directed 401k or what they call Uni-K.
Or just a $70,000. He makes it easier.
What's that, Scott?
She can overfund her 401k and he could use a Roth IRA. It would be the simplest thing to do.
Probably.
State of California, community, proper state. What's mine is yours. Yours is mine. It really doesn't matter whose name it's in.
Right. So you're saying she should take hers and split it 7.5% in Roth and 7.5% in traditional or something?
No,
like that.
I might have him just because he's self-employed. The simplest thing is for him to maximize a Roth IRA for himself. Like next year, you could put in $6,000 of 2019, I should say. Could put in $6,000, and this year he can put in $6,000 into the Roth,
and then she would figure
out the difference on her pay.
Hers will be about 80% pre-tax and 20% after, and his will be 100% Roth.
Just got to do the math.
All righty.
Oh, I see. Okay. Thank you, Steve, very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call.
And appreciate you reading Scott's book four times. Yeah, I'm assuming you don't have anything else to read in your house. Sorry about that, Scott. It's just too easy sometimes.
Thank you. And to continue on, if you'd like to join Handsome McLean, love to take your call on really anything financially related. So it could be retirement. It could be whatever you'd like to talk about. That's financial anyway. 1-888-2-HANSON is the number. That's 1-888-2-HANSON. And we're in Sacramento talking with Tom. Tom, you're with Handsome McLean.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Tom.
Okay, here's my question. 10 years ago, market volatility didn't bother me too much. But now that I'm 66, I have a slightly different attitude.
Yeah, I understand.
And so I am starting to reallocate less stock, more money market.
Okay.
So I'm just wondering, and I have no debt, nice pension, all that. What do you guys think is a reasonable allocation? John Bogle's, advice, keep your age and, use your age and buy that much bond or what?
Yeah. So are you spending any of this money?
Not much.
Do you think you're going to?
Maybe if I buy a beautiful sailboat in the bay, that'll burn a hole in my money.
Is that something you're thinking about doing?
Yeah, maybe.
All right, so that's
a real question.
So the reason is that we have clients that have so much money that they're never going to spend it all, and they know it. We know it, and we tell them, look, what's that?
I'm probably in that category.
Okay. So then what does it matter?
It still upsets me when I look at my portfolio and say, damn it, it went down 50,000.
Do you ever say, man, it went up by 50,000?
No.
Okay.
I think Pat's point is...
The pain is worse than the pleasure.
Okay. So then you could have if you're not going to spend it all, and you don't think you're going to spend any of it...
You can do whatever you want.
You can do whatever you want. You can have 100% in cash. And then you say, well, that doesn't make any sense because I want some upside, right?
Right.
But you could have 100% in equities because you're not going to spend it. It's going to go through market cycles, and we're investing it for your heirs. So.
Or you can buy a nice sales boat in the Bay Area.
I do not have heirs.
Ah.
Okay.
Except maybe the Sierra Club.
Well, that's still an heir. And have you named the Sierra Club as the beneficiary on your IRAs?
Yeah.
You have?
Well, there's about five.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Perfect. Yeah. So there's a middle ground somewhere, right? There's a middle ground somewhere.
What's your allocation now?
It's probably about 40% stock, 60% money market.
You can also make the argument that your pension is a fixed income. And if you calculate the net present value, and figure that, because, I mean, John Bogle doesn't have a monthly pension, although he's about 90 now, and he's still out speaking, by the way. I see him at conferences periodically. But if you wanted to factor in your
net present value of your monthly pension, then
that changed the allocation again.
That would change the allocation to more bond.
Yeah, that's another pile of,
So
money, I think what I like about what you're doing, Tom, is you're not reacting. You're saying, you're trying to figure out what's the right allocation for me at age 66, and I totally appreciate
that. Now that my risk tolerance is starting to fizzle, like my number of pull-ups, I just can't.
Okay. All right. So maybe bring it down to 30%
or whatever you want.
Equities and 70% bonds and cash. They're short-term bonds and cash, right?
Or which is fine. Split the account. I mean, you could split the account and say, you know what? This percentage, I know I'm never going to touch. It's going to go to those five beneficiaries I've got listed. I'm going to let it sit in stocks because it's for when I'm long gone. And so, that's the best possible. And then the rest, I'm not sure if I'm going to buy a sailboat or what, and then have that in a separate account.
And we do that for clients.
Because just psychologically.
It's psychologically because it helps them realize that one is really long term and it's not really invested for them. It's invested for their heirs. There's a slight chance that they're going to use it. Slight chance they're going to use it. Right. And the thing that you should be thinking about, I'm sorry?
So I'm going to say, then the other thing I've been looking at is like the Sierra Club and, you know, Union is Concerned Science. They'll have these deals where, you know, you give them some money now, they give you constant income.
Yeah, a life annuity.
Keep the balance when you croak.
Correct. Life annuities.
So to me, that's a way to do some good with your money, get a little income.
So how much money are you talking about approximately?
Well, I don't know, including rental properties. I don't know, maybe a couple million.
Yeah, how much money is in the investment portfolio, IRAs?
Well, that includes money market, maybe, you know, maybe a million.
Okay. So move it to 30 or 35% equities and the rest is in bonds and cash. And then when you go to do your required minimum distributions, you can actually go, those can go right over to the charities if you're not going to need the money. Yeah. And if psychologically you need to split the accounts, split the accounts. But I doubt you need to. I doubt you need to split the accounts.
And there's no right or wrong. It's whatever you want to do. These are your dollars. You worked for them. You saved them.
Yeah.
I mean, and just because you might have a friend or colleague that has a very different investment approach doesn't mean you have the wrong one.
Right.
And who says just because the market's going up, you need to participate and have the same returns? There's always a cost for that.
Right. Okay. Well, sounds like.
I like the sailboat idea, though, quite frankly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why not?
A hole in the water into which you throw money.
Yes. Yeah. But listen, where we're all ending up, your money won't matter there. So if you don't think if you truly would enjoy it, it would bring some joy to your life.
Yeah.
You know, why not? Right? Do it while you can enjoy it.
Well, I think my main thing is this volatility has me more upset than I thought.
You know, if it really is bothering you, lower your equity position. If it's really bothering you, like, man, I can't handle this, bring it down to 25% equities and call it a day.
Well, right. No, I think I may do that.
Yeah. So it's not. Yeah. If it's bothering you, it's not worth it.
So do you see that people's risk tolerance goes down as they get older?
Oh, no question. It actually goes. It doesn't. It isn't as much having to do with them getting older. It has more to do with the fact that they're spending money and they're not saving. So if you talk to retirees,
and not everyone's risk tolerance changes.
Yeah,
some
stays exactly the same. But what happens is that people have if you've saved your whole life, right?
Yes.
And then all of a sudden you get to the point where you quit saving and now you're expected to spend. It has a psychological implication to many people. In fact, when we do focus groups with our clients of retired clients, they say that and filling their day are the two hardest things psychologically to deal with. One is that they're no longer saving money and they're spending it, and that they find that oftentimes they've got too much day, especially if they were high energy in a profession. So,
right.
All right, Tom. Hey, wish you well.
That's good. Maybe I'll set up an appointment with you guys sometime.
All right. Well, good luck to you. We wish you well. And it's interesting, Pat, thinking about the risk tolerance, it's oftentimes changing circumstances. Someone comes, you know, husband or wife, one of them comes up with cancer.
Or change of risk tolerance.
That's when it's often those things. It's like, I've got this tremendous uncertainty I'm dealing with, which I didn't have before. I don't want the same sort of uncertainty in the financial markets. I mean, sometimes we see things like that as well.
Which is why we're a big advocate of having the house paid off, just because it takes away something to worry about.
Yeah, we don't have that big monthly outflow.
Yeah, it's psychological.
Yeah. Well, we need to take a quick break for the bottom of the hour break here. When we come back, Pat, many individuals contribute some to charity, some a little, some a lot. But regardless, there are some smart ways to do it and some not smart ways to do it.
Yeah, and you'll want to stay tuned as we talk about the most efficient ways to gift to your favorite charities. Yeah.
And we'll continue with calls at 1-888-2-HANSEN. This is Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
Wondering if you're on track with your financial matters? Call now at 1-888-2-HANSON. That's 1-888-2-HANSON.
Want more of Hanson McLean's Money Matters? Visit HansonMcLean.com/radio to get the Money Matters podcast.
Welcome back to Hanson McLean's Money Matters. Scott Hanson.
Pat McLean.
To join Hanson McLean's Money Matters, 1-888-2-HANSON. That's 1-888-2-HANSON. And before we go back to the calls, we'll take some more calls. Let's talk a little bit about a charitable giving, because it is that time of year, and a huge percentage of giving to organizations happens in the month of December.
Yeah, for many reasons.
For many reasons.
Right. One is, it might just culturally be that time of year of giving and appreciation and sharing with others, and it may be 100% tax related, or a combination
of partially tax related,
or a combination.
You know that once
the
December 31st is over, that there's no tax planning for that year.
That is correct.
And it's also, some people say, well, what do I have? How am I sitting at the end of the year? The year's kind of over. Do I have any money to get?
But for tax planning, it can't be it can't be solely tax planning. You have to have you have to have some sort of charitable intent.
Yeah, and there are some creative planning techniques. We're not getting into the details on these things, but like charitable remainder trust, charitable lead trust. There's some nuances around those where you can give appreciated assets, but while you're still alive, you get to have some income for yourself. They can work great, but again, to your point,
in most situations, you have to have some sort of charitable intent for them to... In most situations, you would have been better off keeping the assets and paying taxes on them
if you didn't have the charitable intent.
If you did not have a charitable intent.
But
if
you have an appreciated building you've had for years, or a massive amount in stock you've had for years, and there's some charity that you are already supportive of and feel good about, some of those things could work. But here's where we see many people make mistakes in their charitable giving. They do some charitable giving. And that is, they give out of cash and not appreciated securities. And some people think, well, that's sort of like for the really rich people. I'm not that rich because I only have $1 million. I only have $500,000.
I only have $100,000.
Or I only have $5 million. I mean, even people that others would, the whole wealthy thing's a very subjective term anyway. But to your point, someone with even a modest amount of savings. And here's why. If you have any sort of asset, let's say it's a stock or a mutual fund or a piece of property, something that is appreciated in value, when you sell that asset, you will incur a capital gain tax on that, assuming you've had some gains. So any sort of appreciated, you will incur a capital gain and most likely pay a capital gain tax as a result of that.
Correct.
The tax law still allows, even with this new tax law, it allows you to give an appreciated asset, and you can take a tax deduction for the full market value of that asset, not just what you paid for it.
So the net effect to you is that the charity gets more money the charity ends up with net more money and you end up with the same tax bracket.
You don't have to incur any tax.
Yeah, back. Correct.
So as an example, let's say you give $1,000 a year to the United Way, your church, whatever.
Yes. A charity.
$1,000 a year. But you also have, maybe you had a mutual fund you've owned for years that has some capital gain. Maybe there's a stock that you've owned for years that has some capital gain. Rather than give that $1,000 of cash or a check, if you gifted those securities, $1,000 worth,
they get the $1,000.
They'll turn around and sell that security immediately, and they don't have to pay capital gains on it because they're a nonprofit.
They're a nonprofit, and you get the deduction for the $1,000.
It's a fantastic thing. And if you're thinking, well, wait a minute, I really love that mutual fund or I love that stock. Why? I don't want to get rid of it.
So let's talk about the standard deduction versus itemized deduction, Scott.
Well, the challenge, if you are taking a standard deduction, it's not going to help you unless your standard, your giving exceeds that. So back to your point, if you're doing $1,000 a year.
It depends on your income your deduction.
I've had clients that have doubled up in years.
Sometimes it might make sense to do it every 3 or 4 or 5 years. And how do you do that? Well, how do you do it? Well, the easiest way to do it is to use what's called a donor advised fund. Here's how it works.
Think of it like a
bank account that you direct money into. You get the tax deduction when the money gets into the account.
Or the assets.
And then you decide how it's doled out to the charities.
It's like your own private foundation.
My family has used one for years and years for two reasons. One is it's got great, great, great tax benefits. And I will bulk my giving, which means I'll give some money to the donor advised funds every 2 or 3 years. And then we dole it out to certain charities over a period of time. Now, you're thinking, well, that's only for rich people.
No.
I have clients that are middle class that do this in this technique, and they might give the money there every 3 or 4 years in order to spike into the itemized deduction. So it takes tax planning behind it.
But it can work, and it's not just for
super wealthy people.
No.
Even if you didn't do it, the simplicity of actually giving the money to the charities is what I love about it.
With the donor advice.
Because you just go online.
Most of the major brokerage firms have them.
You just go online and
have a community foundation that has them.
You want to give $500 to the Boy Scouts of America. You go on and you just type in Boy Scouts of America and $500, and they send the check, and it's all accounted for, and your taxes are—it's easy to account for. That's one of the reasons I like them so much. Let's talk a little bit about gifting an RMD or required minimum distribution, because this really doesn't matter what your itemized or standard deduction is.
Yeah, if you are 70 and a half or older, and you're forced to take a distribution from your retirement account, you can give some or all of that required minimum distribution to a charity and avoid any taxation on it. And you're saying, well, what's the difference? Can I get a tax deduction? Well, you might be in a position where you're taking a standard deduction, or most, because the standard deduction is so large now, you're not getting much benefit. So rather than have the money come to you and then turn around and gift it to the charity, you can have money go directly to a charity. Though there is a caveat there. You cannot have it go to a donor advised fund. So, Pat was just talking about how great
everything we talked about, how great the donor advised funds were, doesn't work with the required minimum distribution for whatever reason.
For whatever reason.
But the long and short of it is if you're giving, I don't even know what the number is,
a couple thousand or more a year
to charities. Go back and either talk with your financial advisor
or your tax advisor
and ask them, is there a more efficient or easier way I can do this? Am I doing this correctly?
That's all you got to do.
That's all you do. And that's tax planning.
And if you're sitting, I mean, here it is. We're, only a couple weeks left in the year. It's still not, at all too late to make a charitable contribution.
Not at all.
And
it's no coincidence that you're getting emails and letters and possibly even phone calls from charities right around this time of year asking for money.
And you do have a couple limits. One is you can't, if you gift more than 30% of your adjusted gross income using appreciated securities, that's the cap. And you can't, if you gift more than 60% of your adjusted gross income. You're capped on that as well.
And by the way, Scott, if you're
you can't
if you're
giving, carry that forward.
But if you're giving more than 60% of your adjusted gross income to charity, God bless you.
Yeah, but it could also be a situation like you could have a very modest income. You have an appreciated piece of property you've had for years. You've got a charity you love. Maybe you're getting on later in life and thinking, you know, why wait until I die for this charity to have it? I'm planning on having it now. Why don't I gift it to them now?
Okay.
Either an outright gift or through a charitable remainder trust. That's where you can run into that.
Okay.
Where a modest, that's where somebody can run into that.
That makes sense.
Without them necessarily gifting 60% of their income every year. So anyway, the bottom line is if you're giving more than a couple $1,000 a year, talk with your financial advisor or tax advisor on seeing if there's a more effective way to do it. And I think giving is a healthy discipline for one's finances, as strange as that seems, because none of us really have enough money.
Yes.
It's a fleeting goal. And there's something about when you can get your focus off yourself with your finances that can be freeing from that. Anyway, let's take some calls. 1-888-2-HANSON is to be part of Hanson McLean's Money Matters. 1-888-2-HANSON. We're in Sacramento with Maurice.
Yeah. Hi, guys. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Maurice.
I'm 41. My wife is 35. We have two kids, 5 and 2. We make around 60,000-70,000 a year. What is your best advice for me for a retirement that I don't rely on my on Social Security?
Do you have a 401k through work?
No, I'm a self-employee. My wife, she's a self-employee. We don't have any retirement plan. Right. We don't have any 401k, any IRA, nothing.
Okay, so here's what, I'll just walk you through from the very beginning, right? The very beginning. The first thing you should do is go out and buy some term life insurance policies on yourself and your wife. If you have similar income, you need at least 700.
Don't discount what Social Security provides in survivor benefits, Ben.
Yeah.
It's pretty significant.
Yeah. I would buy $500,000 in term life insurance.
Yeah.
Right? So buy
it's
half.
Cheap.
Okay.
Inexpensive on both you and your wife. Second thing I would do is I would stay away from as much debt as possible. Do you own a home?
We own, our mortgage. It's around $1,200 a month.
And how much do you owe on the house?
Now it's about, I would say, maybe $110,000.
Okay.
And it's in a range of 300, like the worst. Of
and do you owe anyone else money?
No, other than just a little bit in the credit card.
Okay,
and,
perfect. Perfect.
Car payment.
So go and buy the term life insurance policies for you and your wife, and then since you're self-employed, you can set up what's called a Unik or self-employed 401k. I assume you have no employees. Is that correct?
No, I'm
just say Roth IRA.
Yeah, you could do a Roth IRA, yeah. I would do a Roth IRA for the both of you, and I'd buy the S&P. I'd buy the total market.
Roth IRA is your best bet. And set it up on, so a certain amount comes out each month. Forced savings is your best bet.
Yeah. So start it at $300 a month for each one of you, if you can. Right? That's 10% of your income. And set it up so it comes out, and then you want to invest it in the total market. All right.
Okay.
And it's easy to do.
And how? Like, I'm new to this, and
yeah,
I don't
just
know.
Go to Vanguard's website.
Vanguard's
website. Buy the total market. Set up a Roth IRA with monthly distributions that will automatically come out of your checking account. $300 for each one of you. And then go to IntelliQuote.com or SelectQuote.com and buy a 10-year level term for $500,000 on each one of you.
20. I'd do 20 years.
20-year level
term.
You
got a 2-year-old.
Yep.
All right.
All
right, Maurice. We'll wish you well. And let's head to South Florida and talk with Rebecca. Rebecca, you're with Hanson McLean.
Hi.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. Am I online right now?
Yes, yep. You are on.
You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Oh, my God. I'm so glad to be on the air. I had a question for you guys. right now I am 37 years old, and I just wanted to get your opinion on something called the FIRE movement. It's called Financial Independence, Retire Early, mm-hmm. and I'm kind of thinking about that, and I just wanted to get your opinion on it.
So, why? Well, so, we're very familiar with the FIRE movement, and by the way,
you said the movement. I don't know how many people are actually. So let's kind of expand upon this a bit. So for the rest of the listeners, financial independence, retire early. And there's a group, and you can read about this stuff online. There's some bloggers out there. And the premise is essentially this: live an extremely modest lifestyle, save as much as possible so you can retire as young as possible. Is that pretty much it, Rebecca?
Yes.
And live a relatively modest lifestyle.
Extremely modest lifestyle.
In retirement. You know what's curious to me, Scott, is that I have read at least a dozen articles about this FIRE movement, and they always quote someone that has either written a book or has a blog. And then I think to myself, well, isn't that a job? Right? It reminds me of when I was approached years ago by someone that wanted me to sell Amway, and they said, well, you don't really have to work. And I said, well, you're just working right now. You asked me if I was interested. They said, well, this isn't work.
Like, you're approaching me in the produce aisles and be trying to befriend me because you've got this import-export business, but that's not work.
But that's not work. So not that there's anything wrong with Amway. God bless people trying to improve their lifestyle.
Rebecca, so let's assume you had some cash today and you could quit your job. You're 37 years old. What does the next 50 years of your life look like?
Yeah, what's it look like? Let's just assume that you had the money today to do it. What does the rest of it look like?
Well, the rest of it, that I don't know exactly yet. I am thinking about having my own stream of income in terms of having my own business on the side.
Okay. So, but if you had no other job and you were... had your own business, that's not actually retired. You just are self-employed, right?
Yes, exactly.
And that's a completely different subject, right? It is a completely different subject. And so the question you might be asking is not about the FIRE movement, which is how do I set myself up economically to actually take the risk of going into business for myself?
Or how do I get to a point so that I am somewhat financially independent? Maybe totally, but... maybe somewhat financially independent, so there's some breathing room. So we're not, I mean, I think it's wonderful if we could all be in a place where work is an option and not an obligation, and where we can choose our career paths, choose our vocation. I mean, I think the perfect kind of career path for most of us is the intersection of our skill sets, what we're kind of born with, and our passions, and what the market will pay for.
That is, and if you get to that Venn diagram, right, where you'll actually, you'll achieve success, right?
And so often, here's what's interesting, Rebecca. So we've been helping people move into retirement for 25 years here at Hanson McLean.
And into self-employment. This isn't unusual for someone to say, I want to start my own business.
Yeah, but what happens often is people get stuck in a career that's really the intersection between their skills and what the market will pay for, but not their passions. Mm-hmm. And now they're 47 years old. They've got family and everything else, and all these obligations, mortgage, etc. And they feel stuck in this career path, and they're counting down the days till they can retire. And I mean, we've worked with a number of people. We kind of help them figure out, well, what's a career path? What's something you would enjoy doing? And even if it's less money today, how can we make that work? So, and maybe you even have to push retirement off a little, but let's make it so that life can be a wonderful journey and not just try to get this. To this point where we don't have to work anymore.
Okay. I see what you mean.
So let's walk through it yourself right now. Are you single?
Yes.
Okay. How much do you make a year? Approximately.
Almost up in the 90K.
Okay. And are you happy with your job?
Somewhat, yes.
So, but you have a desire to open your own business.
Yes.
And is it in the same industry as what you're working in today, or is it a completely different industry?
It's a different industry.
Okay.
It's a different industry.
So my recommendation to you is save as much as you can, right? And
write yourself a plan as to how to get into that industry. Is that industry, could you support yourself in that industry if you had to?
At this moment, I don't think I probably would be able to.
Okay. You know, I'm going to share a personal, I'm going to share a personal story with you and with the rest of the listeners. So when I was right out of college, I was 20, I think it was 23,
call it, you know, whatever you
23
call it,
yeah. years of age. I had been married for a year and a half. I was 24. My wife and I got married young, and I had an interest in investing. I bought my first stock when I was 18. When I was in college, I had a stockbroker. It was something that actually I had a passion for. I had a great interest in it. I had been reading the Wall Street Journal since I was 16. Like the kids in the neighborhood used to call me Alex Keaton from that.
Really?
Yes. I've never heard that about you.
Yeah.
They would call me Alex Keaton at points in time. And the first job I got out of college was just a job, right? I had waited tables all the way through college. I was making a decent living. I had supported myself since I was 18. I got a job as a pharmaceutical sales rep. It was the worst job. And I've had some bad jobs in my day.
The worst job for you.
It was the worst job for me. I wasn't happy. I was miserable. I did it for 18 months. And I called my dad and said, you know, I can't do this. I'm going to get into financial services. And he said, well, there's a lot of risk in that. You've got a great job. You know, why don't you just kind of stick it out? And I responded to him. I still remember. I said, you know, the worst thing that can happen is if I fail, I'll just go back to what I was doing because they will hire me back. I was good at it. And so when I think about that, and, you know, I had the luxury of not having children. You have the luxury of not having children. I had the luxury of my wife was working and she had a decent job. But I always thought, you know, if you don't take the shot, you'll never know. And the worst thing that will happen is I'll just go back to being a pharmaceutical sales rep, but I'll never question whether I did it or not. And it wasn't about, as Scott said, it wasn't necessarily about making money. It was something that the market would pay for, that I actually understood, and I had a passion for it. And I think that that's the intersection. And I didn't have a passion for being a pharmaceutical sales rep. I still have friends that I started with back 30 some odd years ago are still doing it. And they loved it then and they love it now. But it just wasn't me. So this fire movement,
I don't quite get it.
Which is
I understand
financial independence, retire early. I think people just need to just stop for a minute and say, what's the point?
I like the I like the concept of financial independence, but for most mm-hmm. younger people, that to accumulate that many assets so you never have to worry about generating an income, that's not realistic for most people. But being in a point where debt's not a burden, you avoid consumer debt, you live below your means, you're spending, where you've got breathing room, you've got some money set aside in the bank in case something happens, so. So you don't have any financial stress. That's where most people can get to with just a little bit of discipline, regardless of one's income.
Yeah.
Where you don't have those that financial stress, the kind of stuff that Dave Ramsey talks about with a lot of the what he deals with. But and I think the benefit there is that people have an opportunity to say, well, what is it I want to do? And so if Rebecca, if there's some other kind of career that you think would be fun,
start it.
Go try it. Worst case, you can get, unemployment rate is what for educated people? It's right. Almost nothing.
Yeah.
You know how easy it would be for you? You know how easy it'd be for you? I don't even know what you do, but you know, professional woman, making $90,000 a year, you'd find another job.
Yeah. So go on, swing at it. And if it doesn't work, just go back to what you were doing or make a plan to get there. But the idea that you're going to, you know, frugal and save 70, I read an article the other day about this FIRE movement. This guy said, oh, I saved 80% of my income. And then now I stay at home and then I read the article. Your wife is working full time and she's an executive and you're driving the kids around. It seems like you just became a stay at home dad. Anyway, appreciate the call.
Yeah, I wish you well, Rebecca.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. I'm Pat. I'm always perplexed when I read those articles. I mean, At Hanson McLean, look, we understand a lot of people want to retire, and we've helped people get to retirement and transition to retirement. But even in retirement, I mean, all the studies show that you need to be doing something that adds some value. Most of us need to do something that adds value to someone else's life.
Scott, even our clients, I'm going back in my head to the number of clients that retired in their early 50s and stayed retired.
Very few.
Very, very few. Very few. I've had clients that left corporate jobs and became my one that became a travel agent because that's what she wanted to do. But she thought she was going to retire forever at the age of 52, and she could have. But after, you know, when there's no one to play with, when you're 52, when you're at home and there's no one to play with.
Well, now, I mean, what would life be like if Steve Jobs quit working once he had enough money or Bill Gates quit working once he had enough money?
Well, I think they have different drivers. I don't believe that that's a fair comparison, Scott. I don't think that's a fair. I mean, those guys.
Maybe Rebecca, we just talked to, is the next. Yeah.
Well, maybe she is, but she would. They have different drivers. I mean, everyone has a different driver. I mean, if you really.
I totally understand that.
Really rich people are normally a little bit off.
Oh, yeah. Well, people at the top of their game, and regardless of the career,
are normally a little bit off.
I mean, you think the top athletes, the top artists, the top people in business.
Yeah,
they're driven much more than the average person.
Yeah, or they wouldn't be there.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I look, I'm like, how are you that driven? I mean,
yes,
just it's this relentless, ruthless drive that pushes them forward. But in any case, I mean, our job as financial advisors clearly is to help people accomplish what is important to them and their goals and their dreams. The thing that with this FIRE movement, though. It's not really a movement. It's a handful of people, I think.
For if you just tuned in, it's Financial Independence Retire Early, the FIRE movement, which is, yeah. In almost every article that I've read about this, the people actually have a blog or written a book or they're doing something that actually generates income. And you're not really retired if you're actually working. If you're writing a blog and you're getting advertising on that blog, come on.
You're dealing with the advertisers. You talk to the reporters when they're writing the stories.
You could pretend.
Yeah, yeah. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time in this program. And you're also, Pat, I don't know if you finished your Christmas shopping, but you're getting close on time as well.
I haven't even started.
Thanks for being part of Hanson McLean's Money Matters this week. Join us at HansonMcLean.com for all kinds of great educational tools in addition to the podcast of this program. And we'll see you next week. This has been Hanson McLean.
This program has been brought to you by Hanson McLean Advisors, a registered investment advisory firm. Any ideas presented during this program are not intended to provide specific financial advice, and you should consult your own financial advisor, tax consultant, or estate planning attorney to conduct your own due diligence.